Good afternoon and welcome to Family First with five-time author and top speaker Randy Rolfe. Your family may be facing a variety of issues that you'd like addressed. No two families in the world face identical problems, but Randy has seen almost all of the difficulties families today face, and she and her expert guests have the answers that you seek. Now, here is your host, Randy Rolfe.
Hello, and welcome to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and I'm excited about today's show. I want to make a couple of announcements. We have over 47,000 listeners now every month, and that's over 11,000 each week, which I'm very grateful for, and it makes me feel good that we're getting good information out there and the word is spreading because we're continuing to grow. Also, I urge you to go to my website, www.randyrolfe.com. That's Randy with a Y, and Rolfe is R-O-L-F-E. com. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter that has lots of tidbits about family and health and relationships. And we're also trying to involve our listeners more as friends of Family First. So we're putting together a campaign on Indiegogo where you can get some buttons and stickers and all that kind of fun stuff. So stay tuned for that. Today we're talking about getting to the cause of anxiety and depression. And it seems that more and more people today are being diagnosed and treated for depression and anxiety, and even at younger and younger ages. The media advertisements for pharmaceuticals for these emotional states have increased dramatically. At the same time, the ads we see on TV warn not to drive or work with dangerous machinery while under the influence. Yet people who are being medicated for anxiety and depression can't afford to stop their work and home functions. So many of them are out on the road and going to work. And often the effects of the drugs shift over time, and there are often side effects. So is there another way? My guest this week on Family First is Dr. Jonathan Brower, who has pursued a lifelong study of the inner workings of the unconscious and of how people suffer when they put up walls to avoid being conscious of their real feelings and impulses. His counseling practice focuses on helping people discover the source of their anxiety and depression so that they can overcome it by addressing the root causes. He specializes in a therapeutic process which can have dramatic results in a very short time, and we'll be talking about that. I'll give you a little more background. Dr. Jonathan Brower experienced important people in his early life being nervous, and he didn't even know the word anxiety, but he knew something serious was going on. And some of the people around him had low energy, and they withdrew from relationships, and he wanted to know more. So at age 10, he became a reader of biographies and novels about how people struggle with their emotional challenges. And by 16, he was reading books by and about Sigmund Freud, the father of psychotherapy. For the first half of college, he was in psychology, but then he found many of the courses didn't really address the human struggle for optimum mental health. And I even found that when I was taking psychology courses in the 60s. All they did was do rats in mazes, and it didn't tell me a thing about human relationships. So he changed his major to sociology, where he learned about the social psychology of emotions and relationships. And he went on to earn his PhD in sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's been quoted as saying, "We all have had some degree of emotional pain during our lives, but we don't have to let it cause us to suffer." So welcome to Family First, Dr. Jonathan Brower. I'm delighted to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be your guest and to talk about the topic we're going to be talking about.
Great. Yes. Well, I know it's a passion of yours. So what first got you interested in psychotherapy?
Well, what first got me interested is when I was around 10, not knowing the word psychotherapy, I started becoming aware of how my parents were within themselves, with each other, and with me and my sister, who's 2.5 years older than I am. And, you know, there was quite a bit of sweetness and love in the family, but there was also quite a bit of pathology. My father, who was a surgeon, had low-grade depression. Dysthymia is the term for it, but it's low-grade depression. And my mother was very, very anxious. So, and that's actually part of why I ended up specializing in anxiety and depression later on. So a brief thumb sketch nail with my two parents and their families. So my father grew up in New York City, and he had two very austere parents who were not particularly particularly easy with giving and showing love and affection. And he had a hard time with his parents. They weren't being they weren't physically hurting him or anything, but it was a struggle for him. And when he was 18 years old, his sister, who was 12 years old and who had a she was blocking the word. She was mildly, I'm blocking on the word.
Her, I don't know.
She couldn't be much more than a 12-year-old as an adult. But she didn't look
developmentally challenged,
yes,
or autistic,
was.
Or, yeah.
So at the age of 12, she died of her appendix burst, and she died.
Oh.
At some point after she died, my father's mother let my father know the wrong child died.
Oh, my.
Yes. So that's very stark and very awful.
Oh, yes.
And then my father, when he became a surgeon, he was a general surgeon, lo and behold, a lot of what he did was appendectomies to save people's lives.
Mm.
The reason I'm mentioning this is because the way the unconscious works, we tend to gravitate towards very specific things, but we're usually not aware of why. But in his case, I knew why at some point. I think he did too. And the same with me, with my parents. So my mother's family, she grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And she was the seventh of seven children. And her father, as far as I can recollect and know, was a bit of a rageaholic. He would yell a lot, but he wasn't physically abusive, as far as I know. And his wife, my mother's mother, was very timid and didn't let her husband know that what he was doing was painful and not healthy for the children or
right.
herself. Yeah. So she became very anxious as a child and was till she died. She died a few months ago at the age of 95.
Mm.
Pretty good health up until the last year or so before she died. So that's a big thumbnail sketch there. So when I was around 10 years old, I started being acutely aware of ways in which my parents were kind with each other and the way in which they were hurtful with each other. And the same how they were with my sister and me. When I say hurtful, there was no physical abuse of any kind. But that doesn't
right.
really matter. So around the age of 10, as you mentioned, I started reading books about different people so I could find out, you know, how are they different from my parents. And then I'm not sure exactly when, but probably around 1956 or 57, when Ozzie and Harriet was on TV. Some people listening to this right now don't even know who Ozzie and Harriet were.
Sure.
But they were a famous TV family. Actually, they were the first TV family. And Ozzie, the father in the show, was always available for his kids, and he was playing catch and, you know, football with them, and he was just like a regular pal. So I'd be watching that show and contrasting it to how my father was with me. My father often would be, you know, playful and sweet with me, but being a surgeon, he didn't have a lot of time. He'd leave early and come home late, and a lot of times he'd be woken up in the middle of the night for emergency surgeries. So I didn't get the same kind of thrill being with my father that I imagined I would have had if it had been Ozzy.
Right.
And in Ozzy's and Harriet's family, Ricky Nelson and David Nelson, they were the brothers. Ricky was the younger brother, and he was the superstar brother. There was, even within the show, they tried to play it kind of making it light and funny, but clearly Ricky was the star in the family of the kids. And even though there was a script that was being played, it it appeared to me that something was not quite right, that too much energy was for Ricky and very little towards David. And one postscript there is about half a year ago or so, maybe a year, David Nelson died. He was the fourth and last person of that family to die. And one of Ricky Nelson's sons, Gunner, in the newspaper, there was an article on David Nelson's death, and
sure.
Gunner, Ricky's son, mentioned that David was the nicest human being he ever knew, which I'm sure he had many reasons for it, but my hunch is, or my speculation is, that in addition to what he just said that I quoted, he also could tell that there was something about David and the family that was less special or spectacular than Ricky and even Ozzy and Harriet. So when Ricky was on TV and Ozzy and Harriet, I was about 2 years younger than he was, and I kept following his life through the TV show, and any kind of hairdo he had, I had, and he was my ideal for a long time, up until maybe I was 13 or 14 by then, and no, maybe until I was 14 or 15.
Uh-huh.
So to fast forward, I, as you've already said in the beginning, I went to UC Santa Barbara to be a psychology major, but I ended up going into sociology, which was much more riveting and interesting. And after I finished my PhD in sociology at UC Santa Barbara, I became a college professor, and that was at Cal State University Fullerton. And then I was there from 72 to 99, and I enjoyed my work there very well. And then starting in 1981, while I was busy being professor at Cal State Fullerton, I was also going to Cal State Dominguez Hills and getting a master's degree in marriage and family therapy. So then I was doing both. I was a professor of sociology, and I was a psychotherapist with a marriage and family therapy degree, although most of my patients were individuals. I did some couples of families, but mostly individuals. And then I did what I thought was very good therapy. But then in the late, in the mid-90s of last century, I stumbled across this kind of therapy that's called intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. So before I go on with that, so the therapy is intensive. It's short-term. The way it's short-term is, for most people, it's between 20 and 40 hours, and then they don't need their pills for medications for anxiety or depression. Not in every case, but in most cases. And for some people, it's going to be more than 40 hours. It could be up to 100 hours, depending on different variables. But usually it was between 20 and 40 hours. Sometimes it would be 60 hours. And so it's intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. Dynamic is shortened for psychodynamic, and psychodynamic has to do with the unconscious, which we'll get into in more detail shortly. So people end up having a lot of unconscious feelings and impulses that they keep out of their awareness, and it generally messes their lives up considerably.
That's very powerful. Yes, I definitely want to hear more about that.
So it's intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, And the fellow who started inventing this was back in the 1960s, and he decided he needed to figure out how can I make the therapy short. So what he did was he started seeing patients, and he would videotape every session, and he would videotape to see what he could do to make the therapy be much faster. And I won't go into details of that. That's a whole other story. So,
sure.
But then basically he came across the idea that in order for the therapy to be very parsimonious, meaning very thorough but quick. I'll go back one moment. Before he decided on his specialty, he was either going to be a surgeon or he was going to be a psychotherapist, or psychiatrist, rather. He decided on the psychiatrist. So he realized that the problem that people have that keeps them crippled is their defenses. Defenses are strategies people use to avoid their feelings. So I want you and your listeners to picture a triangle upside down. You know, usually when you see a picture of a triangle, the pointed part, the top of the triangle is on the top. But look at it so that the bottom of the triangle is at the where all the two lines meet. So the bottom one is impulse and feeling. So people start having an impulse. An impulse is what their emotion wants to do. Not necessarily that they would actually do it, but they have an impulse. So for example, if when someone's angry at somebody, the impulse would be to hit the person or to choke the person. But it doesn't mean you would actually act it out. You just have the impulse.
Right.
So a person has the impulse, and then within a fraction of a second or less, they get afraid of their impulse. And then if you go up to the right side of the triangle, we come to anxiety. So then they have anxiety sensations, which are uncomfortable. And then they quickly move to the left part of the triangle, and they go to defense.
Dr. Brower, we're up on a commercial break, and I don't want to rush this description of what happens to a person when they have an impulse, and this is fascinating. We're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Brower, who's a marriage and family therapist and a sociologist, and has a wonderful dynamic psychotherapy approach that is quick and much shorter than a typical psychotherapy process, and helps people get to the root cause of anxiety and depression. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with Dr. Brower in just a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe, has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. We're talking about getting to the cause of anxiety and depression with Dr. Jonathan Brower, and he's been a professor of sociology for over 20 years and also a marriage and family therapist, and he specializes in a psychotherapy that is called dynamic, referring to psychodynamic, and it's intensive and much shorter than a typical psychotherapy course, what he's finding, it's very effective. It was actually founded, and he was telling us something about the origins of it back in the 60s. And so I wanted to pick up where we left off as far as what happens that the founder of this therapy said that the problem was people's defenses, and they've developed the defenses over time unconsciously so that when they have an impulse, they get afraid of it, and it builds into a continuing sense of anxiety. So can we pick up from there, Dr. Brower, and explain what happens next?
But then the healthy response is the mother would say, "Honey, I'm so glad you told me. I had no idea I'd hurt you. Tell me more about it." So he tells her more about it. And at one point, she asks, "And why did you want to pull out my eyeballs?" And he says, "Because you don't look at me. We don't have much contact." I'm using my words. He would use different kinds of words.
Sure.
Yeah. And she said, "Well, I'm so glad you told me that. I had no idea I was being so hurtful. And why did you want to stab me in the heart?" And he said, "Because when you don't pay attention to me and don't spend time with me and don't make contact with me in my eyes, I'm angry at you, and I want you to feel the pain in your heart when you hurt me by ignoring my heart." And then she says again, "I'm so glad you told me, and I won't do this anymore. And if I do this again, please tell me right away, and I'll learn to stop." So this is how it is for all human beings. When human beings have parents who have secure attachment and there's no major attachment bond rupture, everything is fine. However, my guess is, and this is just a wild guess, I could be way off, but probably at least half the world's population have people who had to suffer with attachment bond ruptures that never got repaired. And that's what this therapy is about. So getting back to defense for a moment, and what that means, defenses are strategies to avoid one's real feelings with their impulses and all that. And just to give you an example of some defenses, I'll just rattle off a few. Intellectualization, rationalization, minimization, denial, acting out. So those are some of the formal defenses. But then there are tactical defenses. Those would be things that are verbal or nonverbal, such as being vague in general, diversifying, being sarcastic, argumentative, avoiding eye contact, smiling and laughing. You'll see people who are having sadness, and they'll start smiling and laughing to avoid their sadness, things like that. So most people seem to believe, I don't know how they came to that belief, but they did, they come to the belief that what's crippling them is the trauma that they had at the time, whether it's a one-time trauma or many times, usually it's many times. But the trauma is not what keeps people emotionally crippled. What keeps them emotionally crippled is when they go to their defenses to avoid the feelings and their impulses. That's the problem. So when a patient comes into my office, normally I've had a telephone conversation with them first, and then when they come into my office, they sit down. Oh, by the way, with their written consent, they sign a form that allows me to videotape the sessions. I videotape mm-hmm. the sessions so I can go back and check different parts of the sessions that I may have missed something. And this mm-hmm. is the way most people who do intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, they videotape everything.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they come into the chair, and the first thing I say to them is, what is your problem? And then I'm quiet. And then they'll either start telling me what the problem is, or they'll start rambling. They may be coherent. They may be incoherent. I have to know right away. So if I see someone in my office, and after the first 10 seconds I can tell they're very anxious, I'll wait a little longer. But then at some point, maybe within half a minute or less, I'll say, are you aware of feeling anxious? Some will say yes, and some will say no. People who say no are in deeper trouble than the people who say yes. But some of these people don't come in with anxiety on the forefront. They come in with defense on the forefront. So then if the defense is on the forefront, I start immediately pointing out their defenses, whatever they may be. So if they're being vague in general, if they're being sarcastic, the moment they do that, I, in a very polite way, say, are you aware of putting up a wall? A wall is a metaphor for the defense.
Right.
So right in the very beginning, we start with the anxiety problem or the defense problem, whichever comes first. And we work from there. In this kind of therapy, I don't take a history ahead of time because that would just be all intellectual. Much of it would be intellectualization. What I do is we just work moment to moment with whether it's the impulse, the anxiety, or the defense. So with the example I gave a few minutes ago with little 7-year-old Johnny, let's
right.
just use him as someone who's now, he could be 17, he could be 27, he could be 42, whatever. So, but he started off as a little boy. So when Johnny was a little boy, and when his parents, separately or together, were being hurtful to him, to being cruel to him in some way, and there's different degrees of cruelty, obviously, from very severe to very mildly, Johnny would start having this strong anger in his body. But he was afraid of his anger, and so we quickly go to anxiety. Now he's in anxiety, and he has fear symptoms because anxiety symptoms basically are fear symptoms. And then he goes to defense. Now, if we look at the issue of anxiety for a moment, if you and your listeners are aware of it, when you people out there who have anxiety problems, especially severe ones, you'll notice that 99.99999% of the time, when you have your anxiety, there's no external threat. An external threat would be someone who, let's say, was holding a gun or knife at your throat and wanting your purse or your wallet, or they're going to slice your throat or shoot you in the head. In that kind of situation, there is an actual external threat. And you
sure.
have concomitant kinds of anxiety symptoms, including perhaps urinating or defecating, getting fainting or whatever. But most of the time, people are afraid of what's inside themselves. So little Johnny, who later becomes bigger Johnny and older Johnny, he's afraid of his anger. So it never gets dealt with. But underneath the anxiety, there's always some strong feeling every time. So the good news is, anytime someone has anxiety, when there's, and this is of course with no external threat person, You're just afraid of what's inside yourself. The issue is that you're afraid of what's inside you, and you stay away from the impulse by having to spend time with the anxiety. The anxiety, in some ways, is like a defense because the anxiety gets in the way of feeling the impulse directly. So when the child is young and the parent is hurtful to the child has retaliatory rage to the parent who's been hurtful to him or her. I'll just say him from now on.
Mm-hmm.
So now the child is in a tremendous bind. He's in a bind because he has these murderous retaliatory rage feelings towards his parent, but he also loves his parent. And there's no way his little young brain can take all this in. So what he has to do is he pushes down the feelings of his anger. How does he push them down? He pushes them down by depressing himself. When people get depressed, they push down their feelings, and they have the symptoms of depression, which include, among other things, not enjoying normal parts of the life that they usually would enjoy, having sleep problems, things like that, being isolated, things like that. So so 99% of people who are depressed, they're depressed in order to avoid their anger and rage. Now, what they have to do, this is in their unconscious because they're not aware of this in most cases. They're just aware of being depressed.
Right.
So for the rest of their lives, if they don't get good treatment for this problem, they end up self-sabotaging themselves. They end up making their life miserable. And there's all kinds of ways people do it. You'll hear people call themselves stupid. They demean themselves. People who... this is all unconscious, of course, but they screw up in relationships. They go to work late. They just set it up so that their life is very chaotic and very unappealing. So now if we look at the anxiety part of all this, that when the child has the retaliatory rage in their muscles, in their the muscles for fight or flight, which
right.
are the striated muscles. So all mammals have striated muscles for fight or flight, including, of course, human beings. So when the child, and then later the adult, starts having these strong feelings towards the people who have hurt them, they end up getting muscle tension, and they end up getting autonomic and endocrine patterns. They get sympathetic patterns, parasympathetic, which I can go into in more detail in a minute. So they're in a mess. So there's these two parts. That's why anxiety and depression so often overlap. They can overlap, 10% or they can overlap 100%.
And people can actually vacillate back and forth, too, as I understand it.
Yes.
Yes. I'd like to back up just for a moment, and I think a really important point you made at the start is that many people, when they go into therapy, they think that it's the initial hurt that is still hurting them.
Yes.
If their parent neglected them or was rude and
right.
called them bad names, that's what's still hurting them.
Yes.
But what you're saying is that it's something within them that they were reacting to that as a normal being would be when there's a threat or a hurt. We get angry. We have fight or flight response. And it's that as a child, you can't indulge that emotion because the parents would be even angrier at you, or you love them and you wouldn't want to hurt them. So you either bury it in depression, or you develop a chronic fear, which shows up as anxiety. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, frequently there's plenty of both. It's usually or often anxiety and the defenses.
Yes.
Yeah. So
So this is something that it's not that they have to somehow find a way to heal from the original hurt. They need to deal with their own personal reactions to that hurt, which they're still carrying with them 10,
exactly.
20, 30 years later.
Exactly.
And it sounds like that's one of the reasons this therapy is so effective, because it's something that, you know, they don't have to go back and confront their grandmother or their father. They need to look at their own feelings. Am I correct in stating it that way?
You're 100%. You get an A+. Yes. Yeah. So the matter of the fact is, whatever the ways in which the parent was hurtful to the child, that is something that actually occurred, and that is just the reality of the case. That's what happened. But
right.
It's the defenses when they avoid having their real feelings, that's what keeps them messed up. So in this work, when the patient has access to their strong feelings, when they feel a muscle power in their striated muscles, and when they're not having anxiety problems at this point, or very mild anxiety problems, then they put to words what their muscles want to do. And they visualize it, and they say what it is they want to do. And it can be anything from, it can be anything. It could be taking a baseball bat and hitting the parent in the face with a baseball bat, or they can be giving the parent lots of pain. This is all fantasy, of course. And then finally the parent dies. And sometimes I'm the first one they end up killing in their fantasy.
Let's get back to that, Dr. Bauer. We're up on another break.
Okay.
And it makes so much sense that you find another way, that once they recognize, if they recognize this physical urge coming on, they can channel it in a healthy way, like the 7-year-old who told his mom he wanted to poke her eyes out and stab her in the heart. That's actually a healthy thing for him to be able to express his anger, and you hope the mom will have the sense to take it for what it's worth. So we're going to be back with Dr. Jonathan Bauer in just a couple moments, and we will learn more about this wonderful dynamic psychotherapy that helps a person really overcome anxiety and depression without resorting to hiding the symptoms or over-drugging. So stay tuned.
Okay.
Learn more. Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? 5-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters, whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance. Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe.
To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolf@randyrolf.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Brower, who is a marriage and family therapist, a sociologist, and a psychotherapist. And he's telling us about a wonderful process that is very effective, much quicker than most psychotherapy, which can take years sometimes. It's called intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. And the core of it is, as I understand it, is that instead of trying to go back and review every hurt that a person has experienced and try to find some redeeming sense around that, it's about realizing that as children we build up defenses to get away from our strong passions when we're being hurt, and we want to react, and we develop anxiety and depression in many cases, most cases, you're saying, Dr. Brower, that anxiety and depression come from our ways of dealing with the defenses when we have a very natural physical response to being hurt, even if it's just emotional. So I'd love to get back to where we stopped about what a person does once through this process. They recognize that they do develop a physical sense in their muscles when they get anxious or when they're hiding their feelings in their depression. And what they can do once they realize that, okay, I'm getting tense, there's no external threat, what do I do next?
Okay. Well, there's different degrees of anxiety. So if somebody just has muscle tension in their arms, in their where the striatum muscles are, their arms, their back, their shoulders, all the different parts of the body for fight or flight, when they feel the tension, they're feeling the tension to avoid feeling the energy of the anger. Do you follow?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then for people who have sympathetic nervous systems, for example, they get dry mouth, dry eyes, sweaty armpits, sweating palms, blushing, elevated heart rate. Those, for mammals, that's for fight or flight. And then next comes the parasympathetic nervous system, where people can get lightheadedness, dizziness, fainting, constipation, diarrhea, urge to urinate, nausea, stomach upset, things like that. And then the most severe anxiety is the cognitive perceptual patterns, where they become incoherent, they their mind goes blank, or they're busy, their mind goes racing. They may have a disturbance of orientation where they are in terms of time, place, or persons. And so these kind of things are very severe anxiety symptoms. So it depends, you know, how fast or slow we have to work. The more severe the anxiety, the slower we work. But slower is relative, because for a lot of these people, within the first session, by the way, which is 3 hours in length, they start getting aware of more about their anxiety and their defenses. So
that's great.
One thing that's so interesting, it's absolutely fascinating. It almost always works this way. When people are in my office and they start, you know, they're dealing with their feelings and their defenses, blah, 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 and all of a sudden they feel a pain in their neck or a pain in their chest or a pain in their forehead, and they point it out to me, that I know when they in the fantasy are going to retaliate with their rage towards the parent or caretaker, usually it's the parent, who was hurtful to them. They, all these years, they have been attacking themselves with these pains in their body.
Mm.
This is very psychogenic, meaning they're not doing this self-consciously. It just happens. It happens in them. So I know where they're going to take the, whether it's fists or a rock or a baseball bat or a knife, whatever it is, I know that they're going to be in the in when they put to words what this energy wants to do, this angry energy wants to do, I mean, I know where it's going to be going. And some of
wow.
them already know, too, after a while before the fantasy death takes place. But after the fantasy death takes place...
Let me back up for a moment, because
yes.
before the break, you mentioned that sometimes it shows up first against you. So,
oh, yes.
So how does that work?
Well, so for the patient, they have some loving feelings towards me because I'm trying to help them. But they also, when I point out the fences they use, the walls they put up, even though I'm saying it in a very nice way, they're starting to get angry with me because I'm asking them to be aware of something that they don't want to be aware of. Well, a part of them does want to be aware of it, but the other part doesn't want to be aware of it.
Right.
So it's much safer for them to have their first murderous rage against me. And
right.
then after they do me, then we go to their parents. But sometimes in the middle of them doing me, the retaliatory rage towards me, they'll know that they just quickly flip it over to their mother or father. Do you follow?
Yes, yes,
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. So after the fantasy rage and death takes place, then there's all the other feelings. There's the sad feelings, the guilt feelings, the feelings of pleasure, having hurt the parents, the tremendous sorrow. So we go through all these in great detail. We go through all these phases of what goes on after the death.
Hmm.
It can take 10 minutes. It can take 2 hours. It all depends. And then, of course, at the very end of all this, there's a burial to be had. And some people say, no, I just want to dump my father in the garbage container. I say, no, we're going to have a burial. Then they're going to argue with me for that for a few moments. I said, no, we're going to do the burial, and it's going to be in a place that you pick to have the burial. And 9 out of 10 times, they'll pick a very beautiful, lovely site for the burial. So now, at that point, they're having loving feelings towards this parent they're now burying in the fantasy. Do you follow?
Yes, interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a very short... This is a very, very short way to explain it all. It's much more complicated, but
of course
they get to go through all the stages, and they at the end of all this, they can see their parents as their parents really were, to the best that they can experience that as the child later to be the adult. They can see their parent in a realistic way. They can see the ways in which the parent was loving and grateful to have these children and all that, and they can see the parts of the parents that were hurtful and very unkind, and they can get to have a good sense of that parent, and they can see the parents' good points and bad points. At the point of
so, in a sense, they're putting the whole thing behind them with a new perspective once
yeah.
they've let go of feeling guilty and scared of their own reactions.
Yes.
That can be very powerful.
Yes, and for some of these patients, they may have to kill their parent in the fantasy multiple times. One time may not be enough. So for a lot of people, this sounds very drastic and all, but it actually... is a very kind way to do the therapy. And I also work with couples doing this. So it's common that when people are, when there's a marital couple and they're having difficulties in their marriage, they end up having the retaliatory rage towards each other. But that's really, in most cases, not who the real culprit is. The real culprit is the parent of them, not the spouse. But in the meantime, the husband and wife in the therapy session get to be much clearer about whose anxiety is it they have, whose anger is it they have, and where does it really go. And it's very fascinating when I'm working with couples. A lot of times, one or both of the couples want to use very cruel terms towards the other person, calling them all kinds of bad names. And they want to do that, but they're reluctant to let themselves see what the energy of their anger wants to do to their spouse. But if they allow themselves to see what they want to do to their spouse, if they're both open to this whole idea, the only thing that can happen is they're going to get closer and feel more loving towards each other. Whereas if they're just going to call each other bad names, they're just going to keep living in a very uncomfortable world with each other.
So they really get to appreciate the other person's feelings and
yes.
where they're coming from, and maybe even realizing that, you know, they did have hurt as a child and they're reacting a certain way because of those early hurts. Is that right?
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you, because you have a very gentle manner, and it's almost ironic that you're helping people develop a fantasy of acting out the anger they had when they were 6 or 12 or 17.
Yes.
And so how do your clients react to that? I mean, like I said, I think that that's probably helps a lot for you to have such a gentle manner. Do you find that's a plus in your therapeutic situations?
Yeah, well, most people do this kind of therapy. They are gentle. They are kind. They're not caustic and argumentative or anything like that. But the beautiful part of this therapy is when it's all finished, they have a much easier life. They no longer have to suffer with anxiety or depression. And they can even, and these people, whether it's with good friends or their parents or their children or their spouses, they can also have fun with this. When someone's being hurtful to the other person, they can speak about right then, you know, right now I'm so angry, I want to choke you and have you drown underneath the bottom of the pool. And they can talk about it, and they talk about all the feelings they have about it, and then if they do all that, the only thing they can have is feeling more close to each other.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And what you said earlier about when they can get a sudden pain somewhere, and that actually relates to what as a child they may have wanted to do, like your example earlier of hitting the mom in the eye or in the heart.
And they
might get a chest pain when they're in that therapy, and that helps you realize, did you feel hurt in your heart, or did you want to hurt your dad in his heart? That's a fascinating observation that you've made. So we just have a couple more minutes. I want to make sure our listeners know how to get in touch with you and learn more about this amazing therapy, the Intensive Short-Term Dynamic Psychotherapy.
Okay.
And so if you could give them how to get in touch with you, your website or...
Okay, well, my website is... Well, the three W's and the dot, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's defeatanxietynow.com. D-E-F-E-A-T, defeatanxietynow.com.
And where are you located,
Dr.
Brower?
I'm located in Westlake Village, California. I'm somewhere between Los Angeles and Ventura, or Santa Barbara, we'll say. And
okay.
My office phone number is 818. Area code 707-4557.
Excellent. So if people call you, then you'll chat with them to see if there's something that that you can offer them, and they can come see you for